I think Land Back is the right of return. These are sister movements.
I think, to be honest, the similarities that I see most are actually between reservations and the refugee camps.
What I would encourage and invite our listeners to do is to find those Palestinian voices to lift up, hear from, learn from, and amplify.
I think for Indigenous people, like, that's our call to action. We know how this happens.
Welcome to Challenging Colonialism. This is the second part in a very special three-part series that differs slightly from our usual content. While our podcast typically focuses on settler colonialism in the United States, this episode explores commonalities and shared experiences of genocide between Native Americans and Palestinians. Please note that these interviews were conducted between December of 2023 and February of 2024, and we're publishing this in April of 2024. Yet the genocide continues with no sign of a ceasefire and without an end to the occupation of Palestine in sight. This episode explores the right of return as a land back movement and shares an analysis of the role of new media in the face of genocidal violence. Please be advised that this episode will include graphic discussion of dispossession, ethnic cleansing, and genocide.
My name is Layla Sharif. Palestinians are now in our eighth decade of displacement. And this is a story that is about settler colonialism. So in 1948, 750,000 Palestinians were displaced and dispossessed at gunpoint following a series of massacres, including the Deir Yassin massacre, which is still one that we mourn. This was our first Trail of Tears in the 1948, our Nakba. And since then, when the Nakba happened, many of the Palestinians who were displaced from what is now called Israel went to Gaza. So before October 7, and actually until now, 80% of Palestinians living in Gaza have actually been displaced from a first Trail of Tears in 1947, 1948, 80%. So for example, my grandmother, something I learned recently about my grandmother was she was literate, which was in a largely refugee community in Gaza that was, fresh refugees of children living in camps. That wasn't a luxury that everybody had. And she would just round up the children and tell them stories. And so many of those kids didn't have schools, didn't have running water. So there was a collective way that a way that Gaza became a sanctuary for refugee, for the displaced during the very first iteration of our ongoing displacement. Now we see that that Gaza and all and everybody, whether they are indigenous to Gaza as a place, or they are refugees from other Palestinian cities that have been dispossessed and found their way into Gaza, you know, it is a refugee crisis too, right? This is about refugees who are experiencing ongoing displacement directly as a result of settler colonialism. So you have the refugees in the Gaza Strip who are fighting for their life. You also have refugees who live in places like Lebanon and Syria and Iraq, and when there are regional wars, who is going to be the most vulnerable, right? A lot of times, refugees become at the forefront of other regional wars. And as somebody who worked in refugee relief here in the United States, this was something we saw quite a bit in the War on Terror, where there would be Palestinians displaced to Iraq, displaced to San Diego. Somebody like myself, who I have refugee status, but I'm also a citizen of the United States, right? The U.S. claims me as a citizen. I'm a citizen of the United States. I reap those benefits. But I'm also a refugee in the sense that this is not my home. This home belongs to other people, as a matter of fact. So being a refugee is kind of being in this liminal space where you're always like, in the middle. You're not home and you're not ever going to be accepted anywhere else by virtue of being Arab and Muslim and Palestinian and indigenous, right? And refugees and poor, I mean, all the things. But there is a constant desire, right? That's always the referent is Palestine, even in all these stories of displacement. In my case, somebody like me, my refugee experience has been very different than somebody who lives in a refugee camp, right? I was born in Los Angeles. And that's actually a very interesting story too. My relationship, my being Palestinian in Los Angeles was also dangerous. My family saw a lot of, you know, between discrimination and incarceration, a great number of tragedies on US soil as a result of our refugee status. So when I think of refugees, we have such a diversity of experiences that converge: racialization, what's happening in the US, the so-called overness of the war on terror, but also what the Muslim ban affects us, the ways that Islam has become so racialized and attacks against Muslims have increased 400-fold, right, since October 6th. So it's a liminal kind of identity. But in some ways, I never really accepted my refugee identity because I'm not a refugee of America. I'm a person that belongs in Palestine.
I am Rana Sharif. I use she, her, he pronouns. My connection to Palestine predates, of course, my experience and existence in this world. I am the eldest daughter of Palestinian refugees from Al-Khalil or Hebron. My father, Adib, was actually born in Gaza, and my mother, Salwa, was born in Jenin. And like many Palestinians, they were exiled, forced to take refuge in different parts of the world, and my parents settled here in Los Angeles. And it's really interesting. So as a child, we would travel to Palestine and Jordan because we had family that were refugees and settled in Jordan as a neighboring country. Throughout my childhood. But when I was 4 years old, I witnessed our family home raided by the FBI, and my uncle was arrested for his Palestine activism. And actually, this is probably the first moment, and I was only 4 years old, and I remember it vividly because I was actually sleeping next to him when federal agents raided our home. When I came to know of the racialized repression, Palestinians and Muslims and Arabs and Jordan, even in the diaspora. So there is the connection to Palestine in Palestine, but also the kind of effects of being Palestinian and existing as Palestinian in the diaspora. For as long as I can remember, every conversation about being Palestinian shared with my sisters and I was rooted in narrating what had otherwise been obliterated. Since I was a child, understanding my displaced Palestinian-ness was inextricably linked to the stories that would command each of my sensory organs. And this is something I experienced while in Palestine and in the diaspora. So for example, the taste of olive oil and za'atar. Za'atar is a mixture of herbs that we eat. It's a staple item in Palestinian households. The touch and feel of embroidered tatriz, which is embroidery, Palestinian embroidery, which shifts and changes depending on the location that you're in Palestine, based on the natural topography and geography of the different communities in Palestine. The touch of our soil, our trees, including olive tree, the citrus trees, the almond trees. And I very vividly remember the texture of these as I was growing up and having the great honor and privilege to visit and travel to Palestine. The site of the Dome of the Rock Mosque in Jerusalem and in the Al-Aqsa compound. The sounds of the Islamic culture prayer. The poetry, the sound of poetry, the poetry of Palestinian writer Mahmoud Darwish. The sense of springtime jasmine and fried falafel. All of these texture, indigeneity, they are our commitment and connection to our land that are felt in every fiber of our being. So for my family, my community, to be indigenous is to have these legacies that inform legacies and commitments and connections to our land that inform our relationship and orientation to the land, beyond the land, through the land, with the land. And so I think that, you know, I was born and raised, as I said, in Los Angeles, but even in our home in the far diaspora of, you know, being on Turtle Island and here in Los Angeles, these elements kind of were stitched into the fiber, every fiber of my being, and we would witness them, experience them, take them in. And as I said, we're very honored to have had the privilege to be able to travel to Palestine and spend time in Palestine and actually hold, see, smell, touch, taste all the kind of elements of what it means to be Palestinian.
My name is Noor Judah. I mean, really, the destruction is unfathomable. Every time I try to wrap my brain around it, I'm almost debilitated by the thought. Gaza City, which was really the one Palestinian indigenous urban center we had, is gone. I mean, people talk about North Gaza as if we're talking about this, but North Gaza is, you're talking about Gaza City's right in the middle of that. That's really what you're talking about. And I mean, the city, it really is effectively gone. And that's truly just, it's gut-wrenching. This place that has survived a millennia of invasions and wars, and it's been cleared in a matter of months. So whatever happens now, I mean, I think that's something we are going to be grappling with for years and decades to come. The displacement is unprecedented, even in comparison to the 48 Nakba. Millions of Palestinians who have fled their homes have no homes to go back to. We have been saying for months that this is a push to remove Palestinians from the Gaza Strip, and people continue to insist that that is not what's going to happen. And yet you have over a million Palestinians in Rafah on the border with Egypt, which is an area that previously housed 300,000 people, is now filled with over a million. Where are they going back to? And I am by no means advocating, obviously, for them to you know, be set up in Sinai in sort of the Israeli dream scenario. But the reality of what this is going to mean for their lives is it's incredibly large and monumental. And we, you know, even though a ceasefire is sort of the immediate need, we have to be thinking about what comes next.
The right of return is the right for all displaced peoples to return to their lands. For Palestinians, this means that all of us displaced and exiled since 1948 Nakba and its ongoing iterations that we are witnessing and experiencing till this day, that we all have the right to return to our homeland without question. And you'll see in many Palestinian homes, ours included, my parents, there are keys in front of every single home. And that is a reminder that we will not only want that we should return, that we have the right to return, but that we will return. And so it is our commitment to return to our rightful lands. That is true of all displaced people. Land back is, in terms of the parallels of the punitive state, it's important to understand the kind of ways in which we learn from our indigenous peoples and communities and fam on Turtle Island. And Land Back is a movement that has existed for generations with a long legacy of organizing to ensure that indigenous lands go back to indigenous communities and hands. And I think that that's really important to forefront. Land Back movements is a constant reminder to the state of its failures, in fact, actually, the limits of a neoliberal state. And I think that that's why they're so important. And the kind of persistence and insistence of Land Back campaigns is a way to connect indigenous communities to their rightful lands, but also as a constant and consistent reminder to those who do not know of who are the rightful owners of the lands that we are visitors on, that the kind of traditions and legacies and histories that inform the communities where we are and where we live, everything from the trees to the flowers, to the foods, to the practices of cultivation, to the practices of community. Land Back, in addition to having legacies that reclaim land to their rightful owners, it's also one that kind of expresses in its practice the histories of violence endured by indigenous communities. And so I think it's really powerful for those of us who commit to the right of return to understand the Land Back movement.
My name is Karina Gould. I am the tribal chair for the Confederated Villages of Lashon Nation. When we talk about Land Back, also that we can't just talk about Land Back in terms of human beings, that we have a responsibility as Indigenous people to all that lives on that land, from the mountains to the trees to the little bugs that live underneath the ground, the waters that is alive, the salmon and the steelhead trout and the little frogs and the butterflies and the bees, that land back isn't just for human beings. It's for everything that was first put on that land before even human beings got there. The human beings forget our place in our circle of life. And we're the only ones that forgot what we were put here on this earth to do, to be in relationship with everything else here. And that we as human beings have to come back into right relationship with lands and waters if we want to survive as a species. This idea of land back is for everything to come back into balance. That's what rematriation is. It's about Indigenous women's leadership to bring us back into that balance again, to fight against heteropatriarchy, this idea of war and greed and capitalism, this idea that these things that came here to devour, and that's what they do. They take the soul of human beings and they twist it up and make us think that we are not enough, that we don't have enough, and makes us want more than we need.
I think land back is a right of return, right? Land back is, it's not just a right, it's a state of being that our land, you know, we belong to it and we want to return to it and we love it. And it's not a barren desert and it's not an unproductive landscape. It's a beautiful, generative place that has been the source of life for all of humanity. And so I think that land back and the right of return are part of our future, and they are as much as possible part of our present as well, in spite of these realities. You know, I think that as a person who is in solidarity with Native communities here and considers myself deeply in alignment with Indigenous struggles across the world, these are sister movements, and they are my commitment, both of them. So I believe that Indigenous people from Turtle Island to Palestine have the right to have their land back.
Wars all over the world that are not just killing people, but the earth itself as they're dropping bombs. Land back means that we as human beings have to figure out how to make it back to that circle, to remember that every living thing on this earth has an ancestral calling, and that we are stopping them from doing that or killing them off. That for us to say that one other being on this earth has become extinct because of us is not okay. To know that there are thousands of people that are living without a roof over their head is not okay. Land back is about making us human beings again. When people are able to be in right relationship with the lands and the waters, when they are busy making sure that those are taken care of first, everyone will have enough. That there is too much greed in this world. This idea of capitalism, this idea of taking and taking and taking. We all come here one way and we're all going to leave where nobody's staying. And you're not taking anything with you but the deeds that you have done on this earth. And that hopefully you leave a legacy behind that ensures that the 7 generations after you are gone is going to be able to survive in a better way.
My name is Jennifer Mohanam. To me, the right of return is the single most important principle that I believe should never be given up. It's an integral part of the Palestinian struggle. The right of return, as in the return of refugees and exilees to their homelands, I think has been under threat for many years. I think these recent events, whether what's happening right now in Gaza, where the population is like over 2/3 refugees, and we're seeing a direct targeting of refugee camps and bombings of refugee camps, as well as further displacing already displaced people, these different sort of but repetitive moments of violence directly try to target and erase the refugee question. So not just here, but now, like, in the last, I would say, 10 to 12 years, we've seen a mass exodus, for example, of Palestinian refugees from Syria. We've seen in different moments in Palestinian history, Palestinian refugees camps targeted, completely destroyed. For example, in Lebanon during the Civil War, this is a period that I research and study, but three Palestinian refugee camps were completely destroyed. And that was in the 70s. And before that, you see refugee camps in Jordan being targeted, and then people not necessarily being able to attain or maintain refugee status, depending on what time periods they were displaced. So like Palestinians who were displaced in 1967 didn't get the same refugee status or recognition as Palestinians who were displaced in 1948. So there's constant threat to sort of minimizing and solving this question or sidelining the question of the right of return and the question of refugees through things like resettlement, acquisition of other citizenships, of destroying camps, and hopefully with that, destroying Palestinian refugee identity. So there's all these different ways in which, in my reading and analysis, the right of return is constantly under threat. And you can just like put it next to this Israeli government law of return, which is you could be any form of Jewish descent and you have the legal right to go to Palestine, colonize Palestine, attain Israeli citizenship, live there, have a house provided for you. And there's incentives for people to relocate into the settlements, which are inside of the West Bank for the most part. There's like famous quotes from Zionist state leaders, like the old will die and the young will forget. And I think the condition, especially for Palestinians in refugee camps in the neighboring countries, the condition of being Palestinian and being displaced and having this community makes it so that we actually are not going to forget, especially people that are in the camps, but even anywhere outside in the diaspora, all over the world, our communities always moved together and kind of supported each other wherever they ended up. And so we have groups and contingents of Palestinians in different places, and there are efforts to kind of maintain that memory and sort of communal sense of the homeland. And so I think the creation of the refugee problem, it is a problem for the settler colonial project, and it's not one that's going away. And the life in exile, sort of this inability to return. In 1948, about two-thirds of the Palestinian population being displaced outside of the borders of Palestine, that was about 750,000 people at that time. Now we're millions of people outside of Palestine. And those are, the more accurate tracking is only of those who can be registered through the United Nations Refugee Works Agency registry. And so that doesn't actually even include people like me, for example, whose family immigrated to the United States and is now living in exile. It doesn't include the children of women who were registered as refugees, only the lines of men. So if they, for example, like if refugee women married a Palestinian man who was a refugee but not registered with the United Nations, they would lose their lineage, would lose the technical sort of tracking of the UN refugee status. So our numbers are a lot greater than what the United Nations has in terms of their own documentation.
I think, to be honest, the similarities that I see most, if we're asking specifically about reservations, are actually between reservations and the refugee camps, which extends far beyond the occupied territories. Obviously, every reservation is different. Not all reservations are on the land of, you know, of that population is native to, and some are. And so there's variation in that. But, you know, one thing that is interesting with places like Gaza and the West Bank, in if you're looking also at reservations that are actually on the areas, right, of which the population is from, is that these are spaces prior to being occupied, right? These are spaces prior to being reservations. And so trying to look at those spaces kind of holistically, not just in the moment after they become a reservation or the moment after they become occupied, I think is also really important. It's not something that is specific to Gaza and the West Bank. So including here Lebanon, Syria, Jordan as well. And they are bound together, right, by both tangible experiences like lack of resources, lack of right to movement, statelessness in the larger world, at least a recognized one, but also the intangible pull of always longing to go home and really be at home in every sense of that word, to be allowed to build their lives, right? So sovereignty, not just of their nations, but of their own bodily autonomy and of their futures. And so for me, I think those are really the strongest parallels that you see kind of between these areas, at least, you know, kind of spatially speaking of who occupies them. I'll also add that, you know, you have the population of Palestinian citizens of Israel, similar to indigenous peoples in the US and Canada and Australia and New Zealand, so on, who are maybe not in spaces that we would define as reservations or sort of First Nations territories, et cetera, living in urban centers that are, you know, these settler colonial cities, but they are still, you know, indigenous and on their land in some capacity, you know, is also a parallel that is very striking with Palestinian citizens of Israel, right? Whether they are still in the areas that they were prior to 48 or whether they're internally displaced since 48, the fact that they may be quote unquote citizens of this place does certainly not negate the indigenous experience for them. And so, you know, I think you can find it in whole hosts of the population, of the Palestinian population, far outside of, you know, the territories of Gaza and the West Bank. There's been a lot of talk in the last couple of months about, you know, the phrase from the river to the sea. And the debates around it are sort of very, or that have developed recently, are very sort of reminiscent to those who kind of retort back towards the land back movement as, well, what do you expect us to do? You know, you're trying to wipe America off the map. You're trying to, you know, end the state or whatever. Well, one, yeah, so what if we are? Because it's a settler colonial state and you had no right to this space to begin with. And two, we have to understand that Palestinians and indigenous communities here, you know, here in the US and elsewhere are already living in all of these spaces, whether it's sea to shining sea in the US or river to the sea in Palestine. Palestinians inhabit geographically all of historic Palestine, in Gaza, in the West Bank, in as Palestinian citizens of Israel. Palestinians exist in all of these spaces. And so river to the sea, talking about a liberated Palestine or talking about land back in the U.S. is about understanding a life and fighting for a life of freedom and justice in that in the expanse of that entire geographical space, not just limited to Gaza and the West Bank, not just limited to a reservation, but that people have a right to live with dignity in that entire space and over all of those lands. The anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, the goal was not for Black South Africans to have certain rights within their Bantu states. It was to be able to live with dignity and with full rights in the entirety of South Africa. The same is true and inextricable from sort of conversations around right of return of refugees being able to go home and being able to do so from the river to the sea, not specifically only to Gaza and the West Bank.
So my name is Mark Mensch de Leon. I will say, just based on my own personal experience, having visited there for a short time, it was almost uncanny the kinds of things that I had learned as a scholar of colonialism within the United States to be attentive to and to understand how these kinds of systems work, like just how sort of brutally apparent they were there, right? In terms of like how the occupation operates, in terms of how, you know, the land dispossession operates, in terms of the different forms of confinement, that these were all things that I've learned about in relationship to what has happened to Indigenous people, as well as other people within, you know, what we call the United States, that those are things that are ongoing there. And so there are definitely some similarities of experience. But I think it's really important to focus on the structures that have produced these experiences, whether that's this kind of imposition of a civilizing project that's understood to be Western. This was made abundantly clear recently by recent statements by Israeli officials to be what, fighting the children of darkness, or this being a quote unquote war for Western civilization. I think that's transparent as fuck, sorry. This is all incredibly familiar language that has been used to justify settler colonial violence in the US and in California specifically. You know, just to give an example, like early anthropology in the US sought to define indigenous populations sort of based on the scale of civilization, right? This would move from most primitive to most civilized. And then you have the vacillating sort of religious language there of being demonic, right? Of being an enemy of the particular faith. Both of those were in abundant use within the United States. And so you have that sort of connection as well. But it's also, I think, important to remember that the ties between Israel and the US, that it's not just an historical relationship. Like we see these ties ongoing materially now, right? Many of the police, essentially the domestic colonial force in the United States, are trained by Israel. The US also imports Israeli surveillance technology. And then, of course, there's the power of the Israel lobby in the United States, which impacts what we can say and do in support of Palestinians, right? And so they literally attempt to control the speech that we have and the kinds of things we do with our bodies. And so other than Palestinians and perhaps anti-Zionist Jews, Indigenous Black and Brown people are the primary targets of these forms of suppression, and this has deeply material consequences.
My research broadly focuses on the ways in which multiply marginalized communities use new media as a restorative tool of decolonization. And I look specifically at Palestinians with the hope to kind of extend that and like look at BIPOC communities, especially in this moment as we're speaking right now and this act of genocide that is happening in Gaza. I really want to acknowledge and lift up and offer gratitude to the brave journalists that are coming out of Gaza that are sharing, experiencing, highlighting, streaming, posting what is happening in Gaza. At least 100 or more journalists have been targeted and killed. So we have journalists that are being targeted and killed in addition to creatives, so writers, poets, academic institutions. All the universities in Gaza have been targeted and bombed. Cultural facilities, and not to mention hospitals. And this is coming to us vis-a-vis new media. Many of us are bearing witness to what is unfolding in Gaza vis-a-vis some new form of media, whether that is some streaming device that you have on your phone, whether like YouTube or some techno-mediated application, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok. And I've had the opportunity to travel to Palestine and Palestine and do research over the last over a decade of my lifetime. And one of the things that has become consistently more apparent to me is that people are online. And we're talking, they're online within the context of a state, the Israeli Zionist state, as one that is highly surveillance. So these are people that are online, knowing that everything that they're doing and saying is being monitored and watched, because the surveillance industry in Israel is one of the largest. In fact, that's what they outsource to many other nation states across the world, is their surveillance technologies. So new media is a really important site for understanding the experiences of Palestinians, because they have the opportunity to author their own experiences, to capture, to archive, to present. And the platform, so one of the platforms that I look at is Instagram, which is a photo and video sharing application. And you see many Palestinian authored accounts on there. And what's really important is it creates a generative experience. So there is the content that is presented, whether in video or picture form, whether in a conversation as in an Instagram live, but also people are participating in those conversations in the chats and offering ways to challenge, push back, extend, learn, relearn, unlearn ways of existing and being and understanding Palestinian life in affirmative ways. And so new media is another way to understand, capture, texture the Palestinian life, to express Palestinian sociality, to offer ways of being and existing that is not predicated actually on the state.
My name is Dr. Stephanie Lemston.
You know, we mentioned seeing all the news and all the, you know, the devastation. But in between all of these places, there are also videos of people making food for each other and laughing. I also want to say, as much as I see the parallels between the violence of these states and all the horrors that they've committed against Palestinians and all the horrors that the United States has committed against Indigenous peoples here, that we also share in common our refusal to stop being gentle and to stop being sensitive and funny and giving with each other. And that has been very spiritually fortifying in all of this. And Miriam Kaba has that saying, hope is a discipline. And I think about it a lot because there's a real draw toward despair. But the sense of humor, it shows us that we have to work hard to retain our humanity. I see Palestinians working hard to do that. So I think that is our duty as well.
Hestam, Natoyet Vanessa Escobedo, Ni Noro Mukhe Pork Choki Ampus. Hi, my name is Vanessa Escobedo. Social media is filled with like the literal brutality of people, like they're human beings. And so you're seeing that up close. And then, of course, part of genocide, too, is that, like, you know, erasing that narrative. So if you go seek it, then you can find some of it, right? But if you're watching the news, you're not going to see it. You're not going to see Good Day America or whatever, Good Morning America, talk about genocide on the Palestinian people, right? All the news articles that, you know, we're seeing now is that Israel's defending itself against Hamas. So it's just infuriating to see this genocide happening. And then, of course, it being packaged in a certain way. And of course, this is all part of settler common sense, right? For Mark Griffin saying, right? Like this is how it happens. And this is how people are okay and complicit about it. But I think for Indigenous people, like that's our call to action. We know how this happens. And I think that being complicit is something that we can't be, because so many people were complicit in our deaths and our, even if people didn't know, you know, knew it wasn't right for them to be killing California Indians and selling their scalps, right? Like people still let other people talk about it in public spaces or write about it, you know? So there's a lot of fear, speak up and speak out, because you don't know if your employer might let you go. You don't know if you might be retaliated against. And we see retaliation here as well.
The ways in which Palestinians are quote unquote constructed, presented, shared, is punitive. And so what Palestinians who are authoring their own content in new media, using new media as a tool, are having the opportunity to do is to not only challenge, but to present life-affirming ways, new epistemological traditions and contributions that are otherwise foreclosed actually by the logics of a settler colonial nation state. And so for me, I use these techno-mediated digital spaces, or what I call digital poetics, as a new literary site for understanding, for reading Palestine in a way that's not predicated on state power. And much like the discussion we just had around mainstream media, it completely decenters these master narratives and Palestinians in Hiding Saeed's call for a Palestinian authorship are not actually having to contend with, worry about, deal with the kind of punitive measures of the state, but in fact that they are centering themselves, their own experiences. And by doing so, they are undermining, challenging the kind of, and highlighting the limits of the state.
So my name is Brittany Arona. There are so many Palestinian journalists who are working right now in Gaza, but as we know, they're being targeted. So there's 82, I think, right now. Maybe the number's gone up and probably will have gone up by the time this podcast comes out. But 82 journalists have been killed in Gaza in the last 2 months. Again, it's very targeted. I also go to Decolonize Palestine, which is a nice primer website for people to look at. I think that Palestinians should be the forefront voice. And that any Indigenous voice, including my own, is a secondary thing. I just want to publicly express support for Palestinian people and to help people make those comparisons and to think about how this world is shaped in violence and how that is a continuation and it's not in the past. Genocide isn't in the past. It's very much the present, as we're seeing. So I think that Palestinian voices are very important right now. And I've learned so much in the past 2 months. I think that in mainstream media, there is a tendency to platform Zionists. And I would just be very, very weary of taking at face value what mainstream media sources are saying. Making sure to use your critical thinking skills as you're going through and listening to this rhetoric. So even in the framing, and I mentioned it with the Northwest Indian Wars, like the way that many mainstream, like New York Times, frames it as being the Israel-Hamas war. Again, people occupied, that's not a war, that's a violent occupation against a mostly civilian population. That's not a war, that's a genocide. And it's what they used against us in California to say that we were resistors. We were fighting back. And so it justified them killing our children, our women, our elders, our men. Like that was the justification. So these justifications haven't changed since the 1850s to 2023. So really to think critically about how this, the empire, United States empire, how Israel is framing this, because there is a reason why they frame certain things in certain ways. And it's a reason why they, you know, label Palestinians as terrorists. It's the same thing they did to us too. They labeled us as enemy combatants. We were fighting back against the brutal and violent occupation of our homelands.
The mainstream, I think, has really weakened itself. I think it's losing its credibility anyways, and people aren't watching it anymore. People aren't taking it seriously anymore, so I think that's a good thing. The mainstream media has clearly taken a side, and you can sort of see that in the way in which they approach, especially Palestinians. So even if they're interviewing like Palestinian allies, you can see the difference in approach, very racialized sort of production, really. There's so many kind of parallels I can make, but if you see them interviewing like a Zionist versus a Palestinian, the way they talk to them is very different. Part of what we're missing, I think, in this current moment, of course, all eyes are on Gaza, and we need to be sort of following what's happening there and in tune with what people are experiencing on the ground and activating around this to try to put an end, however, whichever way we can. But people in other parts of Palestine are also being seriously affected, and that's something that we're not necessarily hearing about as well. More people have been arrested than were released during the prisoner exchange, for example, just within that like four-day pause or whatever they want to call it. More people were arrested than were released, for example, and most of those people are coming from the West Bank. So the state created new policies for their own citizens that any kind of sympathy for what's happening in Gaza or for Palestinians is an arrestable crime. And so you see both Palestinians who are citizens of the state, as well as even Jewish Israelis who are not Palestinian, being arrested for expressing like social media support or prayers, just prayers for the people in Gaza, for example.
I think what's really important for us to think about in terms of mainstream media is it is a utility of power. So when we understand it as a utility of power, the expectation is then not to suggest that it's anyone's missing. They're not going to be present because the people that we should be listening to will never be on mainstream media, because it is a utility of state power. It is a utility of the settler colonial nation state. And so when we kind of, it's like a shifting of perspectives. When we start to not privilege that as an important site of knowledge formation, I think then we invite ourselves to kind of look to folks who are doing important work and are able to create content that is not actually speaking to the mainstream, the right, the left, or, you know, these kind of like conglomerates. I think it's important to kind of look at who are the Palestinian communities, collectives, organizations, individuals in Palestine that we can lift up, listen to, and borrow from, as well as in the diaspora. And I think so for me, the question is less about even giving credence to mainstream media, because literally in its like framing, it's mainstream, it's not going to be useful to, as a decolonial praxis, feminist praxis that I embody in the work that I do, it's not going to be useful. It's the master's tools. It is an agent of the state. So for me, it's like, so who are the creatives? What are the, and this is true of Palestinian work and creative workers and culture workers, have always been producing amazing work and art and creative content that isn't speaking to the state, that's not even responding. And I think that that's really important to kind of lift up. And in that, there's a decolonial way in which, for my research, I look at new media as this literary site that offers up something different. And not to say that there aren't punitive measures, because we're seeing how these conglomerates, like, you know, so Instagram, for example, is owned by Facebook and or Meta, I think it's called now. And there's repression and silencing of Palestinian voices. But that's also why we see these spaces as, you know, as Foucault said, wherever there's power, there's the ability to undermine that power. And so we're seeing opportunities for Palestinian content creators, for collectives, for organizations in the, so for example, the Palestinian Feminist Collective or the Palestinian Youth Movement. These are collectives that are in the diaspora and the exile that use media to do political education work. In Palestine, in Gaza, we're seeing a lot of Palestinian journalists, photojournalists using their platforms to highlight and amplify what is in fact happening in Gaza at this moment, at this crisis moment, and bringing that center stage. And there have been repressive tactics by these different media agencies to silence them, but we have found ways to kind of to actually challenge that and to continue to lift up these voices. So what I would encourage and invite our listeners to do is to find those Palestinian voices to lift up, hear from, learn from, and amplify. Because mainstream media is not built to lift up my story. It's not there to support indigenous liberation movements anywhere. And so I do think that one of the things that I'm hoping that my dissertation research will illustrate is that there's a certain poetics of refusal. We actually refuse to engage with mainstream media. That is a form of resistance, that our refusal is actually powerful, and we are creating the spaces and amplifying and lifting up the spaces that are of and from our community, that are authentic to our communities, that are allowing our communities to see and be seen without really validation from the outside. So, and not to get too much into the work, but I frame my current project around the really important work of Edward Said and what it means to narrate the settler colonial context. And I think that learning from Edward Said and heeding his call is that really centering Palestinian authorship. So what are the spaces that Palestinians are authoring their own experiences, and how can we lift them up? And that's really the invitation then. And in that process, we're decentering, delegitimating mainstream media in that process. And we're seeing a shift also in the way in which media is being used, particularly by a younger generation.
I can't say I've ever been so plugged in or fervent about the importance of local journalism. Many of us just watch, looking at our devices, waiting for updates from the dozen, there were dozens, and now the shrinking number of Palestinian journalists who are being targeted, whose families are being targeted as psychological terrorism to stop them from sharing what's happening with the world. Al Jazeera is a really important news source, was a really important news source for me as a person who doesn't want to just watch whatever talking head, you know, say nonsense on CNN or MSNBC or any of those other ones. And what did Israel do? Blew up their headquarters. You know, like that to me was such a signpost of who we should listen to. Like, they let us know by who they're targeting, who are the least often heard and the most needed to amplify voices of this occupation and this genocide. So Israel's own actions have pointed me to who I need to pay attention to, which are young people, like as the future of Palestine, right? They're being targeted and killed, all these children. And the press conference that those children did in early November, begging to live as other children live in the world. It really, of course, was devastating to witness and to think about. I'll be haunted by this my whole life, as many have said. But it also really, as a political act, really affirmed the importance of believing children's experiences and their valuing their view of the world and their personhood and taking care of their futures.
Right now, more than ever, people have been trying to call attention to the stark differences and how resistance in Palestine is being articulated in comparison to somewhere like Ukraine. That's been like a common talking point, right, of different contexts of war. And one community's resistance is that of, you know, freedom fighting, and it's being articulated as resistance. Whereas in Palestine, we're seeing this really intense resurgence of the terrorism language, akin to what we were seeing post 9/11. I mean, it's really reminiscent of that time, and it's having material impacts in the United States in terms of Palestinians and people who are, you know, assumed to be Palestinian or Arab being targeted for hate crimes. In the first week, a six-year-old was killed by his own landlord, stabbed to death, and his mother stabbed, put in critical condition. And then we have the three boys who were shot at, young men, in the Northeast. It was Vermont. There's a lot of different types of smaller level kind of profilings and people feeling threatened, students on campus feeling threatened, getting assaulted and battered, and sort of that not actually meaning a whole lot for administrators. So, and we're seeing, if we want to talk about college campuses, we're seeing the overwhelming majority of universities taking up this terrorism language. My reading of that is that it is taking a propagandized position on the war that's happening right now and the genocide that's happening right now. And that is a mechanism of inciting violence against members of their own campus community. So I think the university's always been a highly contested terrain for the question of Palestine, or always been for decades now. but I don't think people are buying it anymore. I mean, I think some people are for sure buying it. But I think the propaganda machine is just so far off from where the general public is at this point. I think there's already like an Islamophobic sort of anti-Palestinian sentiment that's been present for a very long time in the United States and in Europe, for sure. I think there's a growing population of people who are dissociating from that more mainstream approach. And I think the media and these kind of like linguistic tools are really out of touch with how people are understanding and articulating the world in this moment. I think education within our own communities is really important. I think that's where we can probably make the most impact. And I think it's the most challenging, or one of the more challenging pieces for many communities, but I think it has a big impact. I would say talk to whoever you can talk to, offer resources, you know, share what you think is going on. I know that some of these conversations might be really challenging depending on where your family or your community is coming from, but it's the harder work. It's harder to do that than to show up for a protest or to call a representative. We know the politicians probably aren't going to respond to in any kind of productive way, but you can do that. The harder part, I think, is working with communities who don't agree with us, right? And to try to shift perspective, whether it's in the classroom or at the dinner table or on a social media platform, there are ways to support shifting of the narrative and then definitely to amplify Palestinian accounts and ally accounts on social media, because like everyone's getting shadow banned or just flat out banned. And so I think those are things that we can do. And then any kind of space making or institution building that we can do to draw these connections to different struggles and to raise the question of Palestine and other struggles for justice, I think that's really important work as well.
This is what solidarity looks like. From Wanmapu, Mapuche territory, to Turtle Island, to Palestine, we will all be free. Free, free, Palestine.
Being that I am in comparative literature and languages, I spend a lot of time thinking on language, the way it's written, the way it's performed, the way it's orated. And what I've learned is that settler colonial logics, like colonialism, require a certain framing of the other to actually enshrine themselves into those systems of power. And this is, you know, building on Fanon's work. It's like the settler state requires the native, needs the native in order for it to fortify itself. In the case of Palestine, early on, this assault in Palestine, Gaza, Israeli regime heads actually referred to Palestinians as, quote, human animals. Precisely the language of Fanon cautioned us of, actually. And in the context of Turtle Island, indigenous communities were created as abject others. They were referred to as dangerous, thieves, uncivilized, animalistic, etc. And the use of this language is not accidental, but actually part of a process of conditioning. We see the ways in which Palestine and indigenous communities get written. I think it's interesting to think about the process through which one becomes dehumanized. And I really appreciate you kind of linking these histories, because as you were speaking, Martin, I was just reminded, like, there's a refusal in that. Like, we are not X, we are not Y. And that refusal is powerful. And I think that that's something that building on the tradition of Arab and Arab American writers and thinking through specifically Palestinian poets and writers, like there's this language of refusal that is not just saying we are not X, but also creating generatively a new way of articulation. I think that's really powerful as well.
How are the people who do kind of pageantry as Democrats to give some iota of legitimacy to this farce government? Like, what are they to say? That's a genocide, but then what will they have to say about what their home, you know, what will they have to say about what the United States does? Because if the United States gives billions of dollars to Israel and Israel's doing a genocide, what might that mean about the military projects that the United States has its hands in all over the world and at home? So they turn away because their existence depends on turning away. They want to think, I'm saying the they as like people who don't want to use the term genocide or war crime to talk about Israel's violence against Palestinians. It belies a real commitment to the way things are, which crushes the lives of many under the wheel of empire. And to be comfortable with that level of violence, to collude with that level of imperialist violence around the world, is to tell on yourself, right? To be like, yeah, I absolutely have skin in this game and it benefits me, these harms to others. I didn't give much credibility to the United States government and haven't voted in some years because I don't care. They're illegitimate to me, so they don't get my vote. But they're revealing that to be true. They're revealing our most cynical thoughts about them to be true. Instead of being hand-wringing and despairing about the decay of democracy, I think we should use this really as a pedagogical moment to be like, they were never what they said they were. And their best promises for a liberal multicultural future where we all move past this terrible history, that it's a farce. They have every intention of keeping this violence going. And then the everyday people who won't say the word genocide are helping. You're helping the state. So it's cowardice. It's fear. It's also maybe a lack of knowledge of the legitimate and prior existing polities and sovereignties that are on these homelands. Because I don't feel fearful condemning the United States because I'm Hoopa. And we have a governing relationship with our homelands that has held us for a millennia and could hold all of us, I think. Our homelands are strong enough to hold us all. So why not condemn these states for what they are? They are not long for this world. They're running themselves into the ground and taking us all down with them. So we need other ways. And I think that place in your mind, your imagination opens up when you're willing to push the state aside. Like, it's not worth saving. As they show, they won't even say a word. They won't even say ceasefire. They won't say genocide. They won't humanize the peoples whose lives are being lost. The many thousands and thousands of children is not moving them. What explanation can there be except for deep, deep moral, I don't know, what's the word for that? It's like to be affectively dead, to have no spirited relationship, to have no reverence for life.
You've been listening to the second part of a three-part special edition of the Challenging Colonialism podcast.
As a podcast dedicated to breaking down patterns of ongoing colonialism, we recognize the necessity to help illuminate the commonalities of settler colonial violence happening in Palestine right now. This special series on Palestine is inspired by the outpouring of solidarity from indigenous communities in California and across the globe.
Part 3 will focus on this solidarity with a look at November 2023's Alcatraz Indigenous Sunrise Ceremony, which was dedicated to the Palestinian struggle for justice.
In this episode, you have heard from Dr. Layla Sharif, Corina Gould, Dr. Noor Shuda, Dr. Stephanie Lumsden, Dr. Mark Minch de Leon, Rana Sharif, Dr. Brittany Arona, Dr. Vanessa Escovedo, and Dr. Jennifer Mohana. Thank you for listening.